This episode of Weird Darkness is dedicated to all of you 2020 graduates. Whether you're graduating from one grade to the next, from high school to college, or from college to the professional world, you all have a similar story to tell. At the moment, a frustrating story, not walking across that stage and being handed that diploma, not experiencing that rite of passage. But years from now, you will have something your grandparents, parents, and even your brothers and sisters won't have. A story. You'll be the one person in your family talking about how you celebrated your graduation in front of a computer. Most people past the age of 40 barely even remember their graduation. But you are making history by attending your own graduation ceremony virtually for everyone to see. That's a story you can take with you. So, 2020 graduates, this episode is for you.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Imagine this. It's winter. You, your brother and sister, and some friends are staying in an awesome lodge in the mountains, something you do every year. Everything is great, until a few of your friends decide to play a nasty prank on you. Instead of being the butt of their joke, you take off, only your sister pursuing you. That is, until something else appears. It's large, monstrous, and spewing fire. You both run until you're cornered on a cliff, but you both slip and fall. Your sister dies instantly, but you are still alive. Your body is broken. You can't move, but you're still alive. The creature that was chasing you has disappeared, and no one can hear your screams. 1 year later, your brother and friends return to the cabin. You're not the same person. You're hungry, and you can't control your insatiable appetite. You've become the same as the creature that chased you over the cliff. You are a Wendigo. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new to the podcast, while listening, be sure to check out the website, WeirdDarkness.com. There you'll find the Weirdos Facebook group, my social media links, help for depression and anxiety, the Weird Darkness store, my personal blog, past episodes and show notes, and a whole lot more. It's all at WeirdDarkness.com. This is a Dark Archives episode, so it may or may not have fictional tales mixed in with the true stories, but you can find links to the stories or the authors in the show notes. Whether you're already a Weirdo family member or just now giving Weird Darkness a try, I hope you enjoy this episode. Now bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. When I was a teenager, there was an abandoned mental hospital a few towns over. We used to urban explore it. One evening, we were walking around. It's pretty dark. We hear something, shine our flashlights to the left, and a dude's just walking down the hall, in the dark, no flashlight, in full scrubs. He doesn't say anything, doesn't make eye contact, nothing, just keeps walking straight ahead. We keep our flashlights on him until he turns the corner. We don't say anything to each other, and we don't stop running until we get back outside. Once we're outside, we stop to catch our breath and discuss. All three of us saw it. It was not my imagination. No one ever believes us. I haven't told anyone this story since I was a child, because when I told my cousins what was happening, It scared them really bad, and it got me my second only whooping with a belt by my dad. Now, as an adult, I don't mention it because I just don't know what it was, and I don't want other adults to think I'm nuts. When I was in second grade, I woke up one summer night, dead of night, to a woman floating through my window into my bedroom. Oddly, I wasn't scared. I just sat up and asked, "What are you doing here?" I remember she answered me, but oddly enough, the next morning I couldn't remember what she said or even what her voice sounded like. I couldn't even remember what she looked like. So next I said to her, in true 8-year-old fashion, "Well, you better get going because my dad might wake up and then he'll be mad." She slipped out of my already cracked open bedroom door, and I went back to sleep. Sounds like sleep paralysis, right? Wrong. The next day, I was really excited that I had my own fairy godmother, and I named her Crystal. And I thought in my head, "Please, come back. Come back and wake me up at dawn so we can talk." I kid you not, the next morning, just as it was getting light outside, I hear someone whispering my name. I realized that this was real and she was a ghost, and I froze. I stayed as still as I could, not even able to breathe, and just prayed as hard as I could, "Go away, go away, go away." I could feel her right by my head. As I'm typing this, tears are coming to my eyes. Okay, it happened once. Coincidence, right? Nope. Every time I would get brave and say out loud to her before going to bed in my room, "Okay, come this time, I swear I won't get scared," she would come, whisper my name, and I would almost crap my pants in fear and never open my eyes. At this point, I'm thinking, it still could be night terrors, right? I mean, our eyes have receptors sensitive to light that wakes us up, thus causing me to wake up at dawn and hallucinate this stuff. Well, here's where it all gets real. Next summer, I tell a friend that this is going on while we're camping together. She doesn't believe me, so I ask her to come tonight. We're sleeping in the same tent, and my friend wants to see for herself. At dawn, I hear her calling my name and my friend's name. We don't move. She leaves and we both sit up, and my friend heard her too. She freaks out, tells her parents later that day, sobbing, and I get in trouble for scaring the crap out of kids with ghost stories. Later that summer, I told my cousin this story, and before that night, she freaks out, tells her mom, and I get my ass beat for telling ghost stories again. I just don't think about it anymore, and never when I'm alone at night. First, let me say that my friend is a completely normal guy, and I've worked with him in the engineering realm for quite a bit. He's definitely a smart guy and doesn't have a screw loose, so to hear this story was crazy. It still left me thinking about things like the supernatural up to today. He moved into this house in Portland, Oregon, and it was a little off. When he first moved in, he heard some creaks and stuff, but it was mostly just old house noises. Then sometimes he could swear he heard footsteps or doors creaking open and closed. The most peculiar thing about the house was that even with all the shades drawn up and letting the sun in, it seemed the house was always dark. As some of the noises increased in frequency, so did some strange things. He asked his roommates about the noises, and they all had agreed that they had heard peculiar things around the house, too, in particular, the basement. The basement had some stairs leading down, and from what he described, there were two rooms, the main room with the stairs in it, and another room attached that had an extra door in it on the opposite corner of the first door. He was a drummer, and he had his drums set up in the main basement room to practice drums. The first of the strange things to happen would be in his bedroom. He saw smoke-like stuff coming from under the door, and it started moving up toward the upper corner by his door. He thought the house was on fire as the smoke-like stuff began to cluster in the corner, so he opened the door and was going to bail, but when he opened it and looked into the hallway was totally fine. No smoke, no fire. Then he looked back into the corner and all the clustered smoke had vanished. After that, sometime later, He was in the bathroom, taking a pee, and he heard the door open. Without looking behind him, he says, "Hey, hang on a minute, I'm almost done." But the door didn't shut, so he finished up and then turned around to one of the most frightening things he had ever seen. Clearly, in front of him was an apparition of a young girl in a plaid dress, and he looked at her from bottom to top, and when he got to her face, starting from her feet, there was nothing there, and he could clearly see through her, just a blank face. He was so scared, he said he didn't even remember putting his pecker back in his pants. He just shut his eyes and ran to the door that he thought was open through the ghost, but then he ran straight into it because apparently it was still closed. Frantically, he opened the door without really opening his eyes and scrambled to his bed, and he said he dove in like a little kid and held the sheets over his head until he went to sleep, terrified. Finishing this story, I have such crazy goosebumps. I promise you, it's not bull, but nobody else believes him. I'm going to preface this by saying I went to boarding school for 6 years. This boarding school was in the middle of a one-stoplight town and on a hill 800 feet up. The school used to be an old monastery. It was hundreds of years old and huge. Four stories, including a basement where there was a boiler room and long hallways. I used to be in charge of cleaning the gymnasium at night. Every student had a job that they had to do either at night or in the morning to help take care of the school. It taught you some practical things and all. Anyway, I was there by myself that night, getting ready to start sweeping the gym. The gym had two floors to it. The upstairs part was the weightlifting area, and you could see it fully from the bottom part of the gym where the basketball court was. As I stepped into the gym, one of the basketballs starts rolling a bit. I look around to see if any doors are open, and none are. I chalk it up to randomness, but see that it's continuing to roll. As I watch it, it makes a full circle around the entire gym and then stops right next to my feet. At this point, I am a bit scared, but figured it was nothing. I heard a creaking coming from the second floor, and I looked up. There was a girl there, just staring right at me. As soon as I made direct eye contact with her, she bolted to the stairs that would take her to me. She let out a scream that I cannot describe. I was terrified and frozen in place. Thankfully, she didn't come to me, but took a left and bolted through the main doors of the gym. They didn't open. She just went right through the doors. I noped the hell out of there. I told some of my friends, but none of them believed me. I'm walking home from a friend's who lives on a country road a few kilometers out of my hometown in March of 2001. Another friend's with me. As we walk, we both notice an orange light in a field a few hundred meters to our left. We both glanced at it, but both ignored it, putting it off as a tractor or farm vehicle of some sort. We keep walking when we both get a strong whiff of ozone. Both of us turned and looked at the field just in time to see an orange ball of light a few meters round rise and then rocket into the air soundlessly. We both stood still for a few seconds, then bolted like hell down the road, sprinting until we both nearly collapsed. We ran most of the way back to his place and told his parents what we'd seen. They pretty much laughed at us, and his dad suggested if we'd seen anything at all, which he doubted, it was probably just ball lightning. No one else really believed us either, and there weren't any sightings reported in our local paper. I was walking to the local skate park when I turned a corner just in time to watch a seemingly homeless man against a building wall shoot himself from under his chin. I ran like hell, screaming. It was like a 10-minute walk/run back to my house, at which point I told my dad everything. He calls the police and drives to where I said it happened. 30 minutes or so later, he comes back and says there was nobody there. No blood, no gun, no body, nothing. Three cops questioned me, and I got accused of lying at first, but the sincerity of my horror and detail led them to believe I was developing schizophrenia and maybe hallucinated it. I've never hallucinated a day in my life. This one is from a teacher of mine. He's a great guy, but he swears on his pride that this one is true. It was during his college days. He was living in an apartment with three other guys. They'd been living there for a couple of weeks when weird stuff started to happen. One night, they had some friends come over, so one of them had to sleep in the futon in the living room. The friend was woken up in the middle of the night for no real reason, but when he opened his eyes, there was a thin, blonde girl hunched on the ground next to him. Now, not much can make a 6'4", 250-pound tough guy panic, but this did. He just started hollering and yelling for his friends to come out as he grabbed for every square inch of the sheets. His friends thought he was just messing with them, but his face said otherwise. They just hung out for the rest of the night until they calmed down. They eventually ordered pizza, just because they were no longer tired. When the delivery guy got there, he was surprised. "Hey, this was my old place when I was in school." My teacher chuckled. "Hey, did weird stuff happen when you lived here?" The pizza guy went blank. "Oh, crap, you've seen her too?" They moved out the next day. I have a little brother. He's 3 years younger than me. When I was in sixth grade, we were home alone during the summertime and playing around as brothers do. Wrestling around, chasing each other around the house, etc. Nothing out of the ordinary. I ended up chasing him into our parents' room, and we were throwing stuff back and forth at each other, having a little fake war across the bed at each other. You know, kid stuff. It popped into my head that it'd be funny to scare him by shutting off the lights. Well, there were no windows in our parents' room, so with the lights off, it's pitch black, except for whatever light creeps in from under the door. I retreat to the door and decide at the last second it'd be funnier to leave the room, turning the light out as I passed and close the door behind me, leaving him in the darkness alone. Maybe scare him a bit. So I did. I shut the door behind me as I turned the light off and left the room, turning around to listen to see if he was panicking and wanted me to come back in. But he didn't want me to come back in. "What are you doing?" I heard him say. Yes, he thinks I'm still in there, I guess. He didn't see me leave the room, so I keep listening. "Jacob, what are you doing? You're freaking me out. Please stop." That's odd. I wonder what he's talking about. I keep listening. "Jacob, I'm not joking. Get away from me and turn the light back on now, or I'm telling Mom that you scared me. WTF, get away from me." Did he just say get away from me? Laughing, I yell through the door to him. "Dude, I'm not even in there." He screams loudly, like he's been stabbed or something. I mean a blood-curdling scream. I freak out and try to open the door. It's locked. I didn't lock the door, so why is it locked? My little brother is still screaming, begging me to help him. "Hurry, please!" Now I'm panicking. I have no idea what to do. I'm like 13 years old. I weigh 90 pounds. I can't bust this door down. My little brother's in trouble. I have to get to him. He stops screaming. I try the door handle again, and to my surprise, this time it opens effortlessly. It's unlocked. I open the door and turn on the light, and I see my brother in the corner, crying. After some consoling and apologizing, I finally get him to explain what happened. He tells me that when I turned the lights out, his eyes hadn't adjusted to the light yet, and it was just dark. After about 20 or 30 seconds, his eyes started to adjust, and from the little bit of light leaking in from under the door, he saw me standing in the corner with my back to him. When he asked what I was doing, I, from what he saw, turned to him and started walking slowly across the room toward him. I kept coming until I was standing over him, looking down at him. He said he couldn't make out any features, though, just a dark figure with a shadowy face. He saw a hand extend out towards him and grab his shoulder. The hand was cold and very strong, and it hurt him. When I opened the door and turned on the light, the figure was gone. It just wasn't there. I never saw anything myself. My brother is now 23 years old. I'm 26, and to this day, he will not talk about this event. We have friends who have heard the story through me and will tease him about it. He simply leaves the room, refusing to acknowledge it. He's admitted to me that even almost 15 years later, he is bothered by what happened that day. He still has nightmares from time to time. He still doesn't have any explanation for what happened. Coming up, more eerie, scary, horrifying, or terrifying stories from Reddit users who swear it really happened, when Weird Darkness returns. You've heard me talking about both the Food for the Poor fundraiser and the fundraiser we're doing in the Weird Darkness store to help those suffering from depression and anxiety. It's never ideal to do two fundraisers at once. It gets confusing. But we don't get to decide when emergencies happen. So what I've done is this. The fundraiser in the Weird Darkness store is being extended indefinitely, with all profits this month and 50% of all profits in perpetuity benefiting those who help people struggling with depression and anxiety. But the children and families in Haiti and Guatemala are starving right now and need your donations today, not next month. COVID-19 hit us hard, but it hit these areas even harder, and they're expecting it to get even worse. They too have been forced into quarantine, but they have no government assistance, and their cabinets were already bare before the coronavirus. The low-paying jobs are now gone thanks to the quarantine. The only meals most children received all day came from the school they attended, and now that meal is no longer available because the schools have also been forcibly closed. If you would, please partner with me, partner with Weird Darkness, and partner with Food for the Poor to literally save the lives of these children and families. All it takes to save a life is a one-time tax-deductible donation of just $37. That's it. Just $37 given once. That single gift will feed a child in Haiti or Guatemala for a full 6 months. If you can give a one-time gift of $74, you feed two children for 6 months. If you've been especially fortunate during this trying time and can give $185, that one-time gift saves the lives of five children, giving them emergency food relief for the next 6 months. But again, any amount you choose to donate is going to make a huge impact. But please give now, as you listen to this episode of Weird Darkness. Click the red emergency food relief banner at WeirdDarkness.com. Or if you'd rather, donate by phone. The number is 855-901-4673. That's 855-901-4673. Or click the emergency food relief banner at WeirdDarkness.com. I grew up on the west coast of Ireland in County Galway. One night, when I was around 16 years of age, I woke up in the middle of a gale with rain pelting the windows and wind whistling through the cracks. Now, on this night, there was only me, my mother, and my sisters inside the house, as my father was away minding the cattle due to it being calving season. Normally, I'd be helping him out, pulling calves out of cows' vaginas and the like, but not so on this night. We had these spotlights to illuminate the outside of the house, and one of these spotlights shone directly up into my window, and even with the curtains closed, it would lighten up the room. The shadows of branches and long blades of grass would project onto the ceiling, and the gale, being what it was, caused a frantic wildness to characterize this night's shadow play. I watched the shadows on the ceiling and listened to the wind roar outside for a short while. In fairness, though, I was busting for a pee, so I sat up to take off my blanket and looked over at the door. Well, crap. My view of the door was such that I couldn't see from my bed into the hallway unless the door was wholly ajar. The door was only slightly cracked, but it was open enough to allow the width of a human arm, and there extended into the room was just that. The arm was pale white, and judging by the shape of the hand on the end, it appeared to be female. It had a classic shroud-like sleeve ending a few inches before the wrist. It waved palm side down for about 5 seconds and then retracted. Now the gale and the lights, shadows, and all that was bearable. Even the arm and hand wouldn't have been grand enough. I could have pegged it down to sleep paralysis, but man, the way that arm retracted back into the hallway, and the way the door handle moved downwards as the arm retracted, and the way the door slammed after it, I couldn't breathe. I began to roar and shout. I managed to get my bedside lamp on and covers off, and I began running around the room, opening the door of the hallway into nothingness. Not a soul awake in the house, besides me and the ghost. I ran at 16 years of age into my mother's room, roaring my butt off about ghosts, and she woke up and blearily told me, "Shut up, you'll wake your sisters." Well, I calmed down and slept on the floor in my mother's room that night. Now, that house had been built by my parents, so nobody had died in it previously. Nothing else even slightly paranormal had happened in that house before or since. When I was about 1 year old, I was lying in my crib for a nap, like a one-year-old would do. My mom came into the room to check on me, change my diaper if needed. She said that she found me standing up in my crib, looking at a chair that belonged in the dining room and saying, "Birthday," repeatedly, over and over again. She was freaked out as neither she nor my dad had put the chair in there. Later that day, she was looking at her calendar and saw that it was my grandpa's birthday, and he had passed away a few months previous. She swears to God that it happened, but I don't know if I believe her. When I was 4 or 5, I saw a rubber Scrooge McDuck toy rotate by itself. I kid you not. There was this Explorer Scrooge McDuck toy that I got from a Happy Meal, and I really liked playing with it as a kid. It was maybe the length of a cigarette and had some stereotypical explorer outfit and a mining pick that I continued to chew on until it looked like a mushy stick. Anyway, that unholy toy rotated and made a full 360-degree turn right in front of my eyes while I was alone in the room and standing 5 feet away from it. Naturally, I lost my mind. I carefully turned it so it faced the wall and I ran out of the room. I told my mom, but she didn't believe me. I was persistent, though, and she eventually got ticked enough to decide to throw out this vile toy. When we entered my room, Scrooge wasn't facing the wall anymore. I soiled my shorts, and Scrooge ended up in the garbage. I have no idea what that was all about. I've never experienced anything remotely weird in my entire life after that. I don't really believe in any paranormal stuff. Even if I did, I have no idea what kind of an entity would choose a Happy Meal DuckTales toy to manifest through. But man, for the life of me, I can't explain this. I swear on my life, I am not making this up. A few years ago, I was in the kitchen with my sister and my mom, and I saw this huge spider. This thing was at least 8 inches in diameter, just sitting on the back of one of the dining room chairs. I freaked out and pointed it out to my mom and my sister, but neither of them saw the spider. I turned back to the spider. "It's right there in front of me. Can't you see this?" I asked. As I'm looking at this spider, they both say there's no spider there, and my joke isn't funny. That whole incident still bothers me. I was 11 years old, playing RuneScape on my dining room desktop. Everyone else was in the living room. No cars driving by, nothing out of the ordinary. Just a quiet night in the neighborhood, getting the massive XP gains. Keep in mind, I'm not delusional, and I have no reason to lie. Everything in the room was still as it could be. Everything was okay. But then, all of a sudden, I froze up in fear. I was just fighting some moss giants when I froze up for no reason. And then all of a sudden, the little table that I was playing on started to violently shake. I was frozen. Nothing else in the room was moving but this table. It was shaking so quickly and violently that my mom ran into the room just after it had stopped. She asked what the hell I was doing. She didn't believe me. Nobody did. Anyway, that has always freaked me out, and I still have no idea why it happened. 10 minutes later, I went back to get more XP gains. Nothing has happened like that since. When I was a little girl, I had anxiety-induced anorexia. After a year or two of starving myself because of an irrational fear of choking on food, I finally beat it. Only then, my fear shifted to night terrors. It turns out they weren't night terrors. I had this little black sheep thing that always manifested whenever I became stressed out or terrified. Sometimes it appeared without rhyme or reason. From time to time, it would appear out of the blue, all casually, as though it wanted to play like a pet dog or cat. My mother used to think it was just a figment of my imagination, until one day, she saw it for herself, as did my brother. We get very uncomfortable talking about it. Sometimes, when I'm alone in my house, I hear scratches on the carpet, as though a dog were scampering along, quite loudly too. Sometimes there'd be knocks on walls and doors, the usual haunting stuff. My most memorable memory of it was when I was home alone, and I saw it scuttle into my mom and dad's bedroom, so naturally, as a curious child would, I followed it. It jumped onto their bed, onto the windowsill, and then jumped out the window, 3 stories high. What caught my attention most was that the screen hadn't been ripped or taken out of the window. My dog would bark at it occasionally. I was quite scared of it, even though I'm sure it meant me no harm. I really can't explain it, but I believe things like that don't often happen enough to be believable. When people would call me crazy or tell me I was seeing things, it was so hard to convince them that my mom, brother, and dog couldn't all be crazy too. But nobody ever listens to children. I have one. It's crazy, but funny enough that people always think I'm making it up, despite being able to cross-reference with 2 other people with the exact same story. When I was a kid, my brother and I used to visit our cousins 3 hours away. One time, our parents went out and left my brother and me with my 2 cousins. The older cousin had something else to do, so the 3 of us, probably 10 to 13 years old, were all on our own. For one reason or another, we were in my aunt and uncle's bedroom when I looked into the living room, and as clear as day, I saw a pair of my uncle's disembodied dress slacks dancing away in the living room. Obviously, I freaked out and called my cousin and brother over, and all 3 of us witnessed this happening. There's no way it could have been a prank because the legs were moving, dancing, and everything. There was too much dexterity for them to be controlled by a prankster. To this day, all 3 of us can corroborate this story. My cousin, who is now a missionary, even swears it happened. Despite the fact that it's far outside the realm of her beliefs, when we talk about it, she just takes a breath and says, "Yeah, I remember those dancing pants." We can trace the origin of the Wendigo back to the legends of the Native American Algonquin people, including the Ojibwe, the Salto, the Cree, the Naskapi, and the Innu. Wendigo is plural for Wendigoeg, which roughly translated means the evil spirit that devours mankind. They are believed to roam around the forests along the Atlantic coast and the Great Lakes region where the Algonquin people once lived. Legends say that Wendigoeg were once humans, but were formed when that person consumed human flesh. It did not matter if it were a choice or a means for survival. The person would be overcome by evil spirits and transformed into a Wendigo. Another version of the story says that the very first Wendigoeg was a warrior who made a deal with the devil to save his tribe. In doing so, he gave up his soul and was transformed into a Wendigoeg. When peace was finally attained, there was no more need for the Wendigoag, and he was banished from the tribe, forced to live as an outcast. Regardless of which story you believe, the fact is the Wendigo is a terrifying creature. They have an insatiable hunger for human flesh, never feeling satisfied. This is reflected in their appearance, as they are extremely thin and tall, often measuring at approximately 14.8 feet in height. Their skin is yellowish in color and taut across their bones like leather stretched on a rack. They have long, yellowed fangs and long tongues protruding from a stag skull head. Their eyes, glowing specks in the dark. Bezel Johnston, an Ojibwe teacher and scholar from Ontario, described a Wendigo as gaunt to the point of emaciation, its desiccated skin pulled tightly over its bones, with its bones pushing out against its skin, its complexion the ash gray of death, and its eyes pushed back deep into their sockets. The Wendigo looked like a gaunt skeleton recently disinterred from the grave. What lips it had were tattered and bloody. Unclean and suffering from suppurations of the flesh, the Wendigo gave off a strange and eerie odor of decay and decomposition, of death and corruption. Natives long attributed disappearances of local forest dwellers to the Wendigo, believing they were eaten. The creature has been spotted by more than just Native Americans. In fact, early settlers reported seeing a Wendigo near a town called Roseau in northern Minnesota. They claimed that every time this creature was spotted, a death followed soon after. The question is the Wendigo real, or is it the result of mental illness and susceptible believers? Wendigo psychosis is one of the more dramatic mental illnesses, characterized by an intense craving for human flesh. In accounts reported by Jesuit missionaries, it was reported that humans became possessed by the Wendigo spirit after being in a situation of needing food and having no other choice aside from cannibalism. The following was taken from their reports in the Jesuit Relations. "What caused us greater concern was the intelligence that met us upon entering the lake, namely that the men deputed by our conductor for the purpose of summoning the nations to the North Sea and assigning them a rendezvous where they were to await our coming, had met their death the previous winter in a very strange manner. Those poor men, according to the report given us, were seized with an ailment unknown to us, but not very unusual among the people we were seeking. They are afflicted with neither lunacy, hypochondria, nor frenzy, but have a combination of all these species of disease, which affects their imaginations and causes them a more than canine hunger. This makes them so ravenous for human flesh that they pounced upon women, children, and even upon men like veritable werewolves and devour them voraciously without being able to appease or glut their appetite, ever seeking fresh prey, and the more greedily, the more they eat. This ailment attacked our deputies, and, as death is the sole remedy among these simple people for checking such acts of murder, they were slain in order to stay the course of their madness." One famous case of Wendigo psychosis is that of a Plains Cree trapper from Alberta named Swift Runner. During the winter of 1878, a year of starvation and misery for the Cree people, Swift Runner and his family were starving. His eldest son died, with food and emergency supplies just 25 miles away. However, instead of making a move to get supplies, Swift killed and ate his wife and five other children. His case was not cannibalism as a last resort, but a man with Wendigo psychosis. In the end, Swift Runner confessed to authorities and was executed at Fort Saskatchewan. The legitimacy of Wendigo psychosis has been a highly debated controversy since the 1980s, leaving some researchers arguing that Wendigo psychosis was a fabrication, the result of naive anthropologists taking stories related to them as truth without having observed the behavior itself. Others argued their credible eyewitness accounts as evidence that Wendigo psychosis was a factual historical phenomenon. It was the light that woke me. The light from the nightlight down the hall trickled into my childhood bedroom as I heard the familiar creaking of the opening door. As I looked down my bed towards the only entryway to my room, I did not see anyone that could be moving the door. It was opening by itself at such a slow and consistent pace that it didn't even seem possible without some source of steady force. With my eyes glued to the door and my heart racing, I immediately sat up in my bed, anticipating a hand to reach for the doorknob or for a head to peek in through the gap, or for my older sister to jump in and scare me. She had never played a prank in the middle of the night, but it was the only logical possibility I could think of. The light was seeping in, revealing more and more of my room, and the groaning hinges chilled me and were almost deafening against the dead silence. Terror had its grip on me, and I remained frozen, clenching the blankets around my waist. Just before the door reached its maximum range, it finally stopped. The room was so well lit that I could easily distinguish every corner of my bedroom from my peripherals. I could feel my heart pounding all throughout my body, but I couldn't move, not even to turn on the lamp next to my bed. I was too terrified to move my eyes away from the door in case someone or something appeared. Minutes passed after the door came to a stop, and I remained petrified as my heart continued to pound so hard it felt like waves were rapidly crashing against my whole body. I stared down the hall and hoped to see a string or wire to reveal that someone was just trying to play a trick on me. But no such luck. After staring at the door for almost 15 minutes, I finally chanced a split-second glance at my bedside light so that my right hand would know exactly where the switch was. While I was sitting at the head of my bed and staring at my bedroom door, I shot my hand to the lamp switch. What I saw still baffles me to this day. The door was closed. Up next, what began as a robbery turned into something far more horrific, with the deaths of 8 young women in a Chicago townhouse. A woman explains away odd happenings in her home until she can no longer come up with explanations. And was journalist Danny Casolaro murdered after uncovering a vast global conspiracy called the Octopus? These stories and more when Weird Darkness returns. One in 5 people will suffer from depression during their lifetime, struggling with constant, recurring feelings of hopelessness, sadness, or anxiety. My own depression began when I was a teenager, which isn't unusual. 70% of youth feel their mental health and that of their peers is their greatest challenge. 1 in 9 students self-report suicide attempts before graduating high school, with 40% indicating their first attempts were made in grade school. Depression is real, but less than 50% of those struggling with it are receiving treatment due to the stigma that it carries, the ignorance of the general public about what depression truly is, and a lack of resources to treat it. But there's good news. There are resources. My friends at ifred.org are shining a positive light on depression and sharing free resources to bring people out of it. You can even create a network of hope via their hope training, or even teach hope to kids. Visit ifred.org, the International Foundation for Research and Education on Depression. There you can find information and ideas to end the stigma of depression today. That's ifred.org. Our next Weirdo Watch Party has been postponed for a week, so it's now rescheduled for Saturday, May 30th. Join me, other Weirdo family members, and horror hosts Slash and Foxy Roxy as they present the 1984 B-horror movie Carnage, the story of Carol and Jonathan, a newlywed couple who move into their new house, which they discover is haunted by the ghosts of a newlywed couple who died in the house 3 years earlier. You can be a part of the Weirdo Watch Party for free. Just visit the page and start watching. In fact, there are horror movies hosted by horror hosts streaming on the page all the time, not just during our scheduled watch parties. The chat room is also there, so during the Weirdo Watch Party, we can all join in to chat with each other, comment about the film and the horror hosts, and sometimes the horror hosts jump into the chat room with us to get in on the jokes and conversation. It's free, it's fun, and it helps to promote different horror hosts and show them that we appreciate what they do. So join us for our next Weirdo Watch Party as we view the 1984 paranormal horror film Carnage. Be sure to update your calendar, smart home device, or phone reminder with the new date. It's Saturday, May 30th at WeirdDarkness.com. Again, that's Saturday, May 30th, 9 p.m. Central, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Mountain on the Weirdo Watch Party page at WeirdDarkness.com. On July 14th, 1966, an inebriated Richard Speck stumbled into the townhouse at 2319 East 100th Street in Chicago, Illinois, and took the lives of 8 nursing students. After entering the house, Speck woke up the women who were fast asleep and ordered them into a bedroom, asking for whatever cash they had and claiming that he wasn't going to kill them. But when 2 women from the neighboring boarding house entered number 2319 while Speck was torturing Pamela Wilkening, all hell broke loose. Though it's unclear what Speck would have done had neighbors Suzanne Ferris and Marianne Jordan not appeared, what happened next was a massacre. After killing all 3 of the women, Speck went back for the remaining victims he had been keeping in a separate room, taking them out one by one, raping and killing them until no one was left. At least that's what he thought. Whether he was unaware of how many women were in the house to begin with, or if the unexpected arrival of the neighboring nursing students threw him off, Cora Amaro managed to wedge herself under a bed, out of view, until Speck finally left. She was the only survivor. Amaro was able to bring Richard Speck to justice with her eyewitness account, and with the help of fingerprints at the scene that matched Speck's. Only 49 minutes of deliberation were necessary before Speck was sentenced to death. But how did this young man, who claimed not to remember the night in which he spent hours torturing and killing 8 young women, become a killer? Born December 6, 1941, Speck's home life was unexceptional for his first years. But after his beloved father and his oldest brother died within 5 years of each other, Speck's life began to change. His mother, previously a temperance movement teetotaler, fell in love with a traveling insurance salesman with an eye towards his drink. Speck's new stepfather, Carl Lindbergh, was an abusive drunk who'd been found guilty of forgery and drunk driving. Just a year after brother Robert's death, 12-year-old Speck began drinking. By 15, he was drunk nearly every day. Speck dropped out of school at 16. By this time, he'd already been arrested many times for misdemeanors, including trespassing and disturbing the peace. Speck escalated to violence in his 20s, stabbing 2 people with a knife within a year of each other. At this point, Speck's wife, some 5 years younger than him, left him. With nowhere else to go, Speck moved in with his sister, then back to his hometown in Illinois. Upon his return to Monmouth, Speck became even more violent. In April 1966, Speck raped 2 women, killing 1. But then, Speck seemed to get his act in order. He applied to work as an apprentice seaman with the U.S. Coast Guard in June. Then Speck lost out on an assignment to a more senior seaman. After being kicked out of his sister's apartment, he went on a day-long bender, ending with violence once again. He kidnapped 53-year-old Ella Mae Hooper, raped her, and stole her pistol. but that act was not enough to quench Speck's anger. Later that night, after dinner, Speck took the pistol he had stolen, as well as a switchblade, and set out a mile and a half to a townhouse filled with nursing students. He arrived at 11 that night. Speck had been drinking all day and allegedly also abusing drugs. The seven women in the townhouse soon found themselves in a form of hell they could never have imagined. Five women were shepherded into a bedroom together, while three more hid in a closet. Thinking that they may be able to save themselves, one of the women asked Speck what he wanted. His answer was to go to New Orleans. Each of the women gave the intruder what money they had for a ticket to New Orleans. It seemed that they may have saved their own lives, until a ninth nurse, Gloria Jean Davy, arrived home after her date. Speck panicked and tied up each of the eight women, then took his first victim, Pamela Wilkening, out of the room. Thus began a sick night, as Speck took each woman out of the bedroom, one at a time, to torture and kill them. Meanwhile, Cora Amaro hid under a bed, within earshot but out of sight. Around 3 a.m., Speck's rampage was finished. Amaro remained hidden for two more hours before escaping and finding help. Amaro's ability to stay hidden would prove to be Speck's downfall. On July 16th, a drifter called the police upon seeing Speck's sketch in the paper. Before Speck could be arrested, he attempted suicide. At the hospital, a doctor also recognized Speck from Amaro's sketch, and the mass murderer was arrested on the spot. A number of theories surrounding Speck's violence were proposed, from traumatic brain injuries to obsessive-compulsive disorder and XYY syndrome, which at the time was believed to make men more aggressive than their more typical XY counterparts. Regardless, Speck was quickly found guilty. His death sentence was reversed due to a 1971 Supreme Court decision, but his 1972 resentencing resulted in a 1,200-year sentence. Speck died in prison, December 5, 1991, of a heart attack. This is the truth. Cross my heart and hope to die. Stick a needle in my eye. Spit in my hand and… never mind, that's gross. I'm 65 years old and a recent widow. I've known for some time that there is a ghost or ghosts in my house. We moved into the house in September of 91. It has three bedrooms, four if you count the little room in the basement, and a full-finished basement. We used the basement as a library and family/playroom. The second week we were here, my little girl of 4 years and I were downstairs in the family room watching children's programs. We heard footsteps in the hall upstairs, going toward the bedrooms. She asked, "Who is that?" I told her maybe it was her dad coming home early. Easing my way up the switchback stairs and calling, "Hello," I got no answer. I slipped through the hallway, checking the girls' rooms and finally the master bedroom. No one. And the front and back doors were locked. I told my daughter that it was the pipes cooling off, and she was okay with that explanation. Our cat Squirt liked to stretch out in the hall in such a way that everyone had to step over him. He loved to reach up and grab at our feet as he flipped to his other side. One night at supper, I watched him where he lay in the hall, facing away from me. Suddenly, his ears perked up, and then he rolled to his back, pawing at feet that I couldn't see as they went over him. He seemed to be watching someone continue toward the kitchen. A couple of minutes later, he repeated his performance, flipping the other way, ears perked as he watched an invisible someone go back down the hall. My son chose the small windowless corner room in the basement for his bedroom. For once, he could have the total dark to sleep in. About 2 weeks after the first incident, he came up the steps looking just a little puzzled. I thought Squirt was in the library, but he vanished when I turned the light on, he said. He further explained that he'd seen a small, dark something on the floor a couple of feet from his bedroom door in the dim light from the stairwell window. Once he saw a basketball-sized orb float through the patio room around the living room furniture and through the closed hall door. As he was on his way to the bathroom, he finally went through the door. No orb. He told me about it the next morning. "I think we're haunted," I said. My son and I were actually a bit pleased. No one else was. One time, while sitting at the kitchen table reading, I heard noises in the laundry room and pantry, which is next to the kitchen. I turned enough to see into the room and my older daughter was in there. I figured she was looking for something. After a bit, I asked her if she couldn't find what she was looking for. The only problem was she was at the other end of the house, in her room. No one was in the laundry room. Now that everyone's gone but myself and five cats, we have an agreement, Ghost and I. No scaring the living daylights out of me, and no burning sage in the house on my part. I may have to rethink that. My bed is queen-sized, plenty of room for me and one or two cats. The room is dimly lit by a small nightlight, so I don't have to turn on a light if I have to get up in the middle of the night. I have poor eyesight without my glasses, which I always put on the nightstand. That Friday night, I dressed in my favorite knee-length nightshirt with just a sheet over me, slightly curled up on my left side, burrowed my head in my pillow, and sleep overtook me. My cat Sorrow joined me, curling up in front of me. My other cat Smudge was snoring on my husband's dresser. A rather oddball dream woke me. Lifting my head a bit, the red numbers on the radio clock were visible. 12:04 a.m. I settled back down to deconstruct the dream. As I was thinking through the bits and pieces, it suddenly felt as if the sheet was being slowly pulled down. My legs were bare and I could feel the sheet slide ever so slightly. Ghost is putting one over on me, I thought. Then there was a slight pressure on my feet, pushing them down. Not good, went through my mind. The pressure spread slowly upward. There was a tingling sensation in my legs, as if they were hooked to an electrical nerve stimulator. I didn't feel as if I could move my legs. I was kind of afraid to try. I had that feeling you get watching horror movies when you know the monster is right around the corner, about to jump out. All goosebumps. Gradually, the feeling eased up over my knees. It felt like one of those lead blankets they put over the parts of you they don't want exposed to X-rays. The air seemed to be heavy and thick. My breathing was deep and rapid, and my heart was pounding. All I could see was the dimness, the blurry shadows cast by the tiny nightlight. I could hear Smudge's small snores as he slept on. The pressure and tingling crept to my waist. Every muscle in my body had tensed without my willing it. I had the distinct impression that if I didn't do something, it would take my whole body. I couldn't move, so I did the next best thing. One deep breath. Quit it! My voice was hoarse, unrecognizable to me. Another deep breath. The sensations had stopped creeping, but the lead blanket feeling and the tingling were still there, seemingly waiting for me to give in. A third deep breath. Quit it! Now! The sensation slowly crept back down and was gone. My muscles relaxed, and when I spoke to Sorrow, it was in my voice. One little part of me wanted to pull the sheet over my head and wait for dawn. The bigger part of me slapped it, moved Sorrow and got up to check the house with a quick stop in the bathroom. All was well, except when I got back in bed. I checked the clock again. 2:24 a.m. I know it had read just past midnight when I woke from the dream because I remember thinking 6 more hours of sleep. And the whole thing only seemed to last a few minutes. As an after effect, my right shoulder, elbow, hip, knee, and ankle ached for 3 days, along with a headache in the right side of my head. Let's not meet like that again, ghost. Danny Casolaro was found dead in a hotel bathtub at the Sheraton Hotel in August 1991. The official verdict was suicide. At the time of his death, he was investigating a sprawling criminal conspiracy that he labeled the Octopus. The exact nature and extent of Casolaro's Octopus, or whether it existed at all, has been subject to much debate and speculation since. The cause of Casolaro's death itself was disputed, with many authors and investigators regarding the suicide verdict with skepticism, leading to suspicions that Casolaro was silenced because of what he had discovered about the Octopus. Had Casolaro stumbled upon a vast criminal conspiracy? Casolaro's starting point for his investigation was a real criminal case, a wide-ranging Washington scandal involving allegations that the U.S. government had stolen software company Inslaw's Promise program and added illegal backdoors in order to spy on foreign governments. Casolaro called his conspiracy Octopus for a reason, as he followed the trail from Promise to reveal a much larger story, one that encompassed such seemingly disparate events as the October surprise, the collapse of Bank BBCI, and the illegal drugs and arms trade, all orchestrated by a secret cabal of global elites. Whilst the full extent of Casolaro's Octopus is in dispute, it is based on several real events. Casolaro was found dead in a hotel bathtub, seemingly having slit his wrists and bled to death. However, friends, family, and some investigators immediately doubted that verdict. Suspiciously, the large accordion file with Casolaro's notes and evidence was missing. Casolaro had also been complaining to friends about anonymous death threats he'd been receiving. On one occasion, his housekeeper fielded multiple calls in the space of a few hours, one in which a voice said he was going to cut Casolaro's body up and throw it to the sharks. Paramedics and medical professionals found problematic details in the suicide. One pathologist who studied the autopsy noted the lack of hesitance marks and the savage, deep nature of the cuts to Casolaro's wrists as being highly unusual. This was echoed by an attending paramedic who told investigators, "I've never seen such deep incisions on a suicide. I don't know how he didn't pass out from the pain after the first two slashes." The toxicology report also came under scrutiny. Antidepressants were found in Casolaro's blood, yet he had no history of depression and had never been prescribed the drugs. Despite Casolaro's general thesis having a credible tinge to it, it lacks detail, and no solid evidence has ever emerged to definitely link the multiple seemingly disparate events that made up his Octopus. No evidence from his investigation was ever found after his death, and whatever other leads he may have had were lost with his passing. When Weird Darkness returns, the case was one of the most famous and controversial of the 1950s and went on to inspire the TV show and film The Fugitive, as well as Stephen King's story and film The Shawshank Redemption. It's the true story of the real-life fugitive, Dr. Sam Shepard. Up next. We were really hoping things would be somewhat back to normal this month, but, well, we're all still social distancing and self-quarantining, so I'm going to extend the fundraiser through the rest of this month and beyond. Last month, all profits from the Weird Darkness store went to the International Foundation for the Research and Education of Depression. I'm doing the same this month, and then next month, and into the foreseeable future. 50% of all sales from the Weird Darkness store will continue to be donated to help those who struggle with depression and anxiety. If you purchase something from the Weird Darkness store, whatever portion usually comes to me 100% of it in May 2020, and then 50% every month thereafter will be donated to the International Foundation for Research and Education of Depression. You can check out the merchandise anytime by clicking on store at WeirdDarkness.com. On November 16, 1966, Dr. Sam Shepard was acquitted at his second trial for the murder of his wife, Marilyn, in 1954. The case was one of the most famous and controversial of the 1950s. It went on to inspire the TV show and film The Fugitive, even though the creators deny that. It also inspired Stephen King's story and the film The Shawshank Redemption. Samuel Shepard was born in Cleveland, Ohio, the youngest of three sons of Dr. Richard Allen Shepard. He attended Cleveland Heights High School, where he was an excellent student and was active in football, basketball, and track. He was class president for 3 years. Although several small Ohio colleges offered him athletic scholarships, Shepard chose to follow the lead of his father and two older brothers and pursued a career in osteopathic medicine. He enrolled at Hanover College in Indiana, studied at the Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and then finished his medical education at the Los Angeles Osteopathic School of Physicians and Surgeons. He completed his internship and residency in Los Angeles, but a few years after marrying Marilyn Reese in February 1945, Shepard returned to Ohio and joined his father's growing medical practice. What seemed a promising life was shattered when Shepard was arrested and then convicted for murdering his then-pregnant wife Marilyn in their home in the early morning hours of July 4, 1954. Shepard claimed his wife was killed by a bushy-haired man who also attacked him and twice knocked him unconscious. The Shepard's lakefront home was located in Bay Village, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland just west of the city. Shepard was brought to trial in the autumn of 1954. The case is notable for its extensive publicity and what the U.S. Supreme Court called a carnival atmosphere. Newspapers across the country vilified Shepard in print and were obviously biased against the doctor with their inflammatory coverage of the case. Shepard was portrayed as the only suspect in the case. One headline from Cleveland even read, "Why isn't Sam Shepard in jail?" His suspect, the one-armed man, the bushy-haired man, was dismissed by investigators and reporters alike as a fanciful concoction. The high-profile nature of the case proved to be a boon to lead prosecutor John J. Mahone, who was running for a seat on the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas as the trial began. Mahone won his seat and served until his death January 31, 1962. But things did admittedly look bad for Shepard. It was revealed during the course of the investigation and trial that Shepard had a 3-year-long extramarital affair with Susan Hayes, a nurse at the hospital where Shepard was employed. The prosecution argued that the affair was Shepard's motive for killing his wife. Shepard's attorney, William Corrigan, argued that Shepard had severe injuries and that those injuries were inflicted by the intruder. Corrigan based his argument on the report made by noted neurosurgeon Dr. Charles Elkins, M.D., who examined Shepard and found that he had suffered a cervical concussion, nerve injury, many absent or weak reflexes, most notably on the left side of his body, and injury in the region of the second cervical vertebra in the back of the neck. Dr. Elkins stated that it was impossible to fake or simulate the missing reflex responses. The defense further argued that the crime scene was extremely bloody and, except for a small spot on his trousers, the only blood evidence on Shepard was transfer blood stains on his watch. Corrigan also argued that two of Marilyn's teeth had been broken and the pieces had been pulled out of her mouth, suggesting she had bitten her assailant. He told the jury that Shepard had no open wounds. Shepard took the stand in his own defense. He testified that he had been sleeping downstairs on a daybed when he woke to his wife's screams. He told a vague story, saying, "I think that she cried or screamed my name once or twice, during which time I ran upstairs, thinking that she might have a reaction similar to convulsions that she had had in the early days of her pregnancy. I charged into our room and saw a form with a light garment, I believe, at that time grappling with something or someone. During this short period, I could hear loud moans or groaning sounds and noises. I was struck down. It seems like I was hit from behind somehow, but had grappled this individual from in front, or generally in front of me. I was apparently knocked out. The next thing I knew, I was gathering my senses while coming to a sitting position next to my bed, my feet toward the hallway. He further said, "I looked at my wife. I believe I took her pulse and felt she was gone. I believe that I thereafter instinctively or subconsciously ran into my youngster's room next door and somehow determined that he was all right. I'm not sure how I determined this. After that, I thought that I heard a noise downstairs, seemingly in the front eastern portion of the house." He ran back downstairs and chased what he described as a bushy-haired intruder or form down to the Lake Erie beach below his home, before being knocked out again. The defense called 18 character witnesses for Shepherd and two witnesses who said that they had seen a bushy-haired man near the Shepherd home on the day of the crime. The jury, however, was not convinced. December 21, 1954, it found Shepherd guilty of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. Soon after his conviction, Shepherd twice received devastating family news. On January 7, 1955, his mother committed suicide by gunshot. 11 days later, his father died of a bleeding gastric ulcer. In both cases, he was permitted to attend the funerals, but was required to wear handcuffs. After more than 6 years of appeals, Corrigan died on July 30, 1961. Months later, F. Lee Bailey took over as Shepherd's chief counsel. Family tragedies also continued during this period. On February 13, 1963, his late wife's father, Thomas S. Reese, committed suicide in an East Cleveland, Ohio motel. Shepherd served 10 years of his sentence. After several appeals were rejected, his petition for a writ of habeas corpus was granted by a United States District Court judge on July 15, 1964. The state of Ohio was ordered either to free Shepherd or to grant him a new trial. The case was reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court in Shepherd v. Maxwell. The court held that Shepherd's conviction was the result of a trial in which he was denied due process. The decision noted, among other factors, that a carnival atmosphere had permeated the trial and that Edward J. Blythen, the trial judge, had refused to sequester the jury, had not ordered the jury to ignore and disregard media reports of the case, and when speaking to newspaper columnist Dorothy Kilgallen shortly before the trial started, said, "Well, he's guilty as hell, there's no question about it." At his new arraignment on September 8, 1966, Shepherd loudly pleaded not guilty with his attorney F. Lee Bailey by his side. Jury selection got underway on October 24th, and opening statements began 8 days later. Unlike the original trial, neither Shepherd nor Susan Hayes took the stand, a strategy that proved to be successful when a not guilty verdict was returned November 16th. The trial was very important to Bailey's rise to prominence among American criminal defense lawyers. It was during this trial that Paul Kirk presented the blood spatter evidence he collected in Shepherd's home in 1955, which proved crucial to his acquittal. After his acquittal, Shepherd helped write a book which presented his side of the case and gave insight into his years in prison. He also returned briefly to medicine in Youngstown, Ohio, but was sued twice for medical malpractice by the estates of dead patients. After that, his life went into a tailspin. He never really recovered from the trial, accusations, and years in prison. He worked briefly as a professional wrestler, going by the name The Killer, and became a raging alcoholic. He died of liver failure April 6, 1970. By the end of his life, Shepherd was reportedly prone to drinking as much as 2/5 of liquor a day. He was buried in Forest Lawn Memorial Gardens in Columbus, Ohio. but his story was not over yet. In 1997, his remains were exhumed for DNA testing as part of the lawsuit brought by his son to clear his name. Shepard's son, Samuel Reese Shepard, had devoted considerable time and effort toward clearing his father's reputation. In 1999, he sued the state of Ohio in the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas for his father's wrongful imprisonment. At the trial, attorney Terry Gilbert, who had been retained by Shepard, suggested that Richard Eberling, an occasional handyman and window washer at the Shepard home, was the likeliest suspect in Marilyn's murder, after a ring that had belonged to Marilyn Shepard was allegedly found in his possession. Eberling died in an Ohio prison in 1998, where he was serving a life sentence for the 1984 murder of an elderly, wealthy Lakewood, Ohio woman, Ethel Mae Durkin, a widow who died without any immediate family. Durkin's murder was uncovered when a court-appointed review of the woman's estate revealed that Eberling, Durkin's guardian and executor, had failed to execute the decedent's final wishes, which included stipulations on her burial. Durkin's body was exhumed, and additional injuries were discovered in the autopsy that did not match Eberling's previous claims of in-house accidents, including a fall down a staircase in her home. Coincidentally, both of Durkin's sisters, Myrtle Frey and Sarah Bell Farrow, had died under suspicious circumstances as well. Frey was killed after being savagely beaten about the head and face and then strangled. Farrow died following a fall down the basement steps in the home she shared with Durkin in 1970, a fall in which she broke both legs and both arms. In subsequent legal action, both Eberling and his partner, Obie Henderson, were found guilty in Durkin's death. DNA testing of Richard Eberling's blood in connection with the Shepard investigation to see if there was a match with the blood found at the murder scene was inconclusive. Prosecutors argued that the blood evidence had been tainted in the years since it was collected, and that it potentially placed 90% of all Americans on the crime scene. Blood collected from a closet door in Marilyn Shepard's room was type O, while Eberling's blood type was A. Eberling had admitted at home and stated he cut his finger while washing windows and bled while on the premises. This has been cited as evidence of Eberling's involvement in the murder, although some questioned why Eberling would account for his blood being in the house. Though Eberling denied any criminal involvement in the Shepard case, a fellow convict reported that Eberling confessed to the crime. Kathy Collins Dial, a home health care worker for Durkin, also testified that Eberling had confessed to her in 1983. The credibility of both witnesses was seriously called into question during the 2000 civil trial. F. Lee Bailey, Shepard's attorney during the 1966 retrial, insisted in his testimony in the 2000 civil lawsuit that Eberling could not have been the killer. Instead, Bailey suggested that Esther Houck, wife of Bay Village Mayor Spencer Houck, had killed Marilyn in a fit of jealous rage after finding out that Marilyn and her husband had had an affair. The Houcks were neighbors of the Shepherds. Cuyahoga County Prosecutor William D. Mason led the state of Ohio's trial team, which included Assistant Prosecutors Steve Dever, Kathleen Martin, and Dean M. Boland. They argued that Shepard was the most logical suspect and presented expert testimony suggesting that Marilyn Shepard's murder was a textbook domestic homicide. They argued that Shepard had not welcomed the news of his wife's pregnancy, wanted to continue his affairs with Susan Hayes and with other women, was concerned about the social stigma that a divorce might create, and killed Marilyn to get out of his marriage. Prosecutors asked why Shepard hadn't called out for help, why he had neatly folded his jacket on the daybed in which he said he'd fallen asleep, and why the family dog, which several witnesses had testified in the first trial in 1954, was very loud when strangers came to the house, had not barked on the night of the murder, recalling the famous Sherlock Holmes remark about the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime, with its implication that the dog knew the criminal. After 10 weeks of trial, 76 witnesses and hundreds of exhibits, the case went to the 8-person civil jury. The jury deliberated just 3 hours on April 12, 2000, before returning a unanimous verdict that Samuel Reese Shepherd had failed to prove that his father had been wrongfully imprisoned. On February 22, 2002, the 8th District Court of Appeals ruled unanimously that the case should not have gone to the jury, as a wrongful imprisonment claim could only be made by the person actually imprisoned, and not by a family member such as Sam Reese Shepherd. Legal standing to bring such a claim, the Court of Appeals found, died with the person who had been imprisoned. In August 2002, the Supreme Court of Ohio affirmed the appeals court's decision. The Shepherd case continues to be a mystery to this day. Technically unsolved, it's unlikely that we will never know for sure who killed Marilyn Shepherd in that Cleveland lake house. Thanks for listening to this episode of Weird Darkness. If you like what you heard, please help the podcast grow and recommend the podcast to your friends and family. I'd also greatly appreciate a 5-star rating in the podcast app that you're using with a few nice words about the podcast. It helps to get the podcast noticed by others. Do you have a dark tale to tell of your own? Click on Tell Your Story at WeirdDarkness.com, and I might use it in a future episode. Also on the website, you can find the Weirdos Facebook group, paranormal and horror audiobooks that I've narrated, the Weird Darkness store, my contact info and social media links, the events calendar. Plus, you can visit the Hope in the Darkness page if you're struggling with depression, anxiety, or thoughts of suicide. And if you listen to the podcast at your place of employment, be sure to check out the Weird at Work page. Every month, I randomly choose from the entries one business to give a shout-out to, and I also send them a Weird Darkness Weird at Work prize pack. This has been a Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness. You can find links to the stories or the authors featured in this episode in the show notes. Weird Darkness is a registered trademark of Marler House Productions. Copyright Marler House Productions 2020. I'm Darren Marler. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness. And until next time, John 12:46.